Okay, welcome to Lecture 3 on Kant's Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. This will be a shorter lecture on actually my favourite part of the critique, and basically the part of the critique that I believe if you can understand this, then you can understand the overarching idea of the critique, the point it's trying to make in terms of its actual original philosophy, of which there is a lot. But this is the section I always sort of would emphasize spending some time with and making sure you understand. It's actually one of the most basic sections and one of the most, you know, one of the easiest to understand, I believe. Before we sort of jump forward, I do have some recommended reading again. So, of course, the Hackett edition of The Critique of Pure Reason. I recommend reading the section, The Transcendental Aesthetic, which is what I'm talking about today. I recommend reading pages 36 to 40 of the Prolegomena. And also there is an online article called Kant's Views on Space and Time by Janiak. But heading in to the critique. So the Transcendental Aesthetic is primarily, if not entirely really, focused on objects and sensibility. That is, you know, sense data, how we sense things, how we sense objects, and the way in which objects are sensed by us, by the subject. So the first claim of the Transcendental Aesthetic is that space and time, or time and space, the ordering is somewhat important, we'll get to that. Time and space, space and time, spatio-temporality, provide us with our sensible form of experience. They are the two building blocks needed for any possible experience at all. They are the foundations of all possible experience for the human subject. Kant states that time and space are both a priori intuitions. That is, they are absolutely necessary and universal intuitions, which are not derived from any type of empirical experience. They are needed for there to be empirical experience at all. So in that sense that they are pure. These things aren't derived from experience. They are brought about by our very innate features of sensibility. So then the Transcendental Aesthetic is attempting to answer the question, you know, in what way do we, or are we, sensing something, right? We've brought forward these two foundations of time and space that we absolutely need. They're, you know, that are universally a priori, they're necessary. You can't have experience without them. So from this sort of foundation, in what way are we sensing something? And that is, you know, when we see a chair, when we see a computer, we sense something in space. The Transcendental Aesthetic then is asking the question of what allows us to sense that thing, categorize it, and conceptualize it. You know, how do we make sense of things in experience? So it's an attempt then again to put things into an objective framework. And so the question of how, from this sort of tumult of impressions, we sensibly sort of receive them and end up with what we perceive to be reality, you know. So, you know, to repeat that, when we're out in the world, when we're out in experience, when we're out in reality, we're obviously receiving, you know, when we see a tree, we're receiving brown, we're receiving the texture of rough, we're receiving the green of the leaves, the shimmer of the leaves, we're receiving the massive impressions. What is Kant is asking, what is the objective framework which allows our senses to be able to cohere this thing into something which we can categorize and recognize? And the Transcendental Aesthetic itself might not be particularly related to, you know, aspects of categorization and conceptualization in themselves, but it is working towards and building up to the actual framework which allows us to do that. And of course, once again, you know, it begs repetition that one must remember transcendental is meant in relation to the conditions of experience and what allows them to be possible. So a transcendental aesthetic is the conditions which allow that aesthetic experience, that sense experience, to be possible at all, and a critique of these conditions, right? You know, is the thing that we're receiving in empirical experience real, or, you know, is something happening in that apprehension? And, you know, this is built up from time and space. So for Kant then, time and space aren't features, they're not features of absolute reality, but only for features of our subjective reality of the subject. Everything which is found within time and space, the objects of our experience, are represented to us, and they're not things in themselves. Now, of course, there could be people who might say, well, how do we know time and space are not features of absolute reality? Kant does this time and time again in the critique, where he puts things forward and he makes sure that we only know, he's, you know, we're only talking about what we definitely know we know. And of course, that's only related to our subjective intuition and experience. That's all we can know. So when Kant is sort of stating these aren't features of absolute reality, always with this one, he's saying this isn't it, but with subjective reality, we can understand it. He's stating, well, it could be, it could not be. The point isn't whether or not we try working out. The point is we can't know because we are attending to reality through our subjective faculties, right? So everything within time and space, the objects of our experience are represented to us, right? So once again, it's like the sunglasses metaphor, or, you know, seeing, you know, because we have to sense them, because we have to use our subjective faculties to sense the external world, they're not presentations, they are re-presentations. Therefore, do we have the real thing? And they're not things in themselves, right? So what's a thing in itself? The thing in itself is the thing, the object, or whatever it is out there in the real world, we can't say what it is, before it's represented to us, right? So don't take this as how it is, but I'll give you a metaphor. Say there is a blue amorphous blob out there in the real world. That's the thing in itself. But when we sense it, it turns red, right? We'll never know the true reality of that thing, because our collective subjective intuitions always just senses that re-presentation. And so this manifold of sensory experiences first appear as appearances, right? You just have appearances first. This is Kant's language of appearances. They come first, and then they come to represent or re-present something, okay? So it's appearances first, then representation, right? Kant scholars are going to dunk on me and dive on me for this. This is the point where I think I understand when you're trying to do this, you know, this systematic philosophy. There is obviously appearances, representations, and intuitions, and it all happens so quickly within subjective intuition that you're often one is wondering, well, why do we need all these terms? You know, appearances are those things just as they appear, and nothing has yet happened to them. There are, you know, as I say, this is where Kant scholars would disagree with me. There are obviously clear reasons as to why Kant is using this language, but I think when you're first tackling the critique, the importance is understanding why a representation is a representation, a representation. You know, things appearing is there. That's just the first thing that appears, then it's represented, right? There's no process in the appearance. And so with these appearances, we carry this spatio-temporal framework, this objective framework of time and space. It's always already. It's absolutely necessary, right? It's not something of the external world which begets itself. But the foundations of space and time, in the way we process them, they are what allows receptivity altogether. But of course, it has to be coherent. It has to have necessary preconditions which aren't related to experience, and thus has to be pure. We absolutely need this foundation of pure intuitions of time and space for there to be experience. Now, why is this? Okay, it's fairly simple. You start with space, strangely enough. You'll see why that's strange. It's clearer to us, right? For there to be objects, for there to be material, to be matter, to be objects which we understand to be in experience, in our experience, or in reality, or in the external world, they have to be in space. However, for us to be able to process them, for instance, let me take this pen. For this object, which is an object in space, for this object to go from here to here, there has to be a passage of time. So that's where this reversal of not space and time and space. Because for there to be space, it has to be first in time. Otherwise, we simply can't process it. And so that is why it's not like we build up these time and space. We intuit time and space to have experience altogether. We are intuiting these representational forms of reality. And of course, you know, you can bring in these sort of metaphors of whether or not an alien species with a completely different cognition to us or mode of sensibility to us would apprehend space and time the same way. Once again, that's the same thing. We can't know because even if they showed us their results, we'd still only be able to interpret those results via our sensibility. And so once we remove the baggage of rationalism and empiricism, we can begin to understand that our relationship to objects is twofold. Okay, so when you think back to the rationalist and empiricist frameworks, one is being extremely, it subsumes everything into intelligibility, and one subsumes everything into sort of physicality. And both don't separate these, whereas Kant does. And so actually, once you move away from these, from rationalism and empiricism, you begin to understand that our relationship to objects in the world, in the external world, is twofold. Okay, the way in which an object is given to us via our senses, and the way in which we actually process that or think of that object as a concept, right? And so this is what's called intuitions. Okay, intuitions are those representations of the way in which objects appears to us, and the concepts are the means in which we think about objects. Okay, intuitions are to do with appearances. Intuitions, appearances. When we intuit something, we first had that appearance, then we intuit it. It's the representation, but that's primarily to do with the sense data of that object. And concepts are the means in which we think about the object. The object appears, we intuit it, represent it, represent it to ourselves, and then we are, you know, able to conceptualize, think about that object and understand what it is. And these are two separate things which work together. So this twin process of intuition is the way in which we immediately process objects. It's the way in which we immediately process objects, right? They appear to us, we process them by conceptualizing them and understanding them within sense data, okay? We conceptualize objects by a process of mediation, by way of assessing that which the said object has in common with other objects. So our conceptualization is a certain form of association, but there is differences with regard to the associations of Hume and Locke, which we get to much later. Concepts, however, must relate, Kant says, relate ultimately to intuitions. Okay, so once again, the sensibility and the concepts are split, and this is why I mentioned the usage of language earlier, because when you begin to think of these things as separate, it's all relatively simple to put together this systematic philosophy, but everything in reality happens so fast. Okay, so, you know, I sense it's an object and I understand it's a pen within that same framework, and it doesn't seem to be divided. So I think there's sort of three ways, you know, you can understand the sensibility, you can understand the conceptualization, and then you could also understand actually this all happens in one thing, which we get to later on. There is a term for this. So concepts must relate ultimately to intuitions, Kant says in A19, B33. But we must first represent an object via sensation before we can conceptualize it. Right? Intuitions, then, are singular representations of particular objects. A concept, by contrast, is inherently general. It's that which connects particulars into a generality. An intuition is of a singular particular. Concepts apply to more than one particular. An intuition of this singular pen, the only one that is in the world, even though there's others, of course, there is others in terms of manufacture, but this is the only one in terms of this physical object in this space. The concept, however, is a generalized concept. I'm trying to get the pen in the right background. A generalized concept of a pen, a writing instrument, etc. The concept is a generalization which allows us to navigate the world. You know, we see a tree, we see one tree. That is that single tree in sensibility. But our brain doesn't then look at another tree and have to work it out all over again, right? You know, there's plenty of different species of tree, which I've definitely never seen. So if I traveled to Australia and saw a load of new trees, I would still understand from my conceptualization of those sensible objects that they are in that categorization, that concept of tree. And that's why it's general. Intuition then is reliant on sensibility, of course, because it has to, you know, it has to rely on the senses, on the sensible object. But it is passive in relation to the subject's receptivity of what it senses. Okay, so, you know, sensibility isn't doing anything when I see this. It's not sensibility which is working anything out. It's just a passive, like, a car drives past, I hear it. It's only concepts and conceptualization which actually allow me to make anything of that noise and understand that it's a car. My senses, you know, my actual hearing or my taste or my touch, these don't do anything in themselves. Concepts, on the other hand, are caused by the faculty of understanding, which actively produces and applies concepts to these passively received objects. Okay, so Kant agrees with empiricism here in that sensation is entirely a posteriori, you know, that is, it has to be experienced based on empirical experience of this external world. But there is a noticeable difference in Kant between intuition and perception. Okay, so when we get to intuition and perception, the former holds no concepts inherently. Okay, you know, there's no inherent conception in intuition, that's related to just sensibility. However, when we talk of perception and perceiving things, if I perceive this, the latter, you know, perception, it presupposes concepts. Okay, so the transcendental importance, okay, perception doesn't arise too much, but there is a difference there in Kant, and I think it's worth mentioning. The transcendental importance, then, of these two ideas, intuitions and concepts. Okay, historically, the importance is that Kant is separating these two realms. But the importance with regard to the text is that they create some clear alterations of our epistemological understanding of the world, our epistemology, how we know what we know, how we, you know, sense what we sense. Is reality reality? Is our experience our experience? So intuitions don't account for any knowledge on their own. Okay, sensibility doesn't work anything out. So there's no knowledge in sensibility. It doesn't. It's just that processing. Sense processing, making sense. These are simply just sense data afforded to us. That's what sensibility is. It's just data. We haven't done anything with it. If, and this is important for Kant, this is very important for Kant, actually. I think he repeats it a few times. If the concept is removed entirely from our structure of experience, there is no knowledge remaining. Okay? There would just be this intuition in the object, but I mean, it's difficult to think about. How would you, what would you do with an object which you can't conceptualize? What's this if you have absolutely no knowledge of anything? It's nothing. Kant concludes then that the knowledge of an object needs an intuition, an immediate sense experience, knowing it via, you know, sensing it, and a concept. That's one of the most sort of fundamental bits of the transcendental aesthetic. With space and time, build everything. Pen is in space. It's now going through time, because I have to process it from going here to here. It takes time, whatever that means. But I have to receive the pen, sense data, but I also have to conceptualize it, which means understand what the hell it is, which is, it's a pen, because I understand the concept of a generalized pen. Kant states then, in one of his more lucid and understandable quotes, "Without sensibility, no object would be given to us. Without understanding, no object would be thought. Thoughts without content are empty. Intuitions without concepts are blind." That is, I will continue the quote, but this is just me now. "Thoughts without content are empty." That would be the concept without relating it to experience. And intuitions without concepts are blind. That is experience without conceptualizing it. To continue, "It is therefore just as necessary to make our concepts sensible, that is, to add the object to them in intuition, as to make our intuitions intelligible. That is to bring them under the concepts." So you always have to be combining these two things for anything to make sense. These two powers or capacities cannot exchange their functions. Okay, you're not suddenly going to start, the sense data is not suddenly going to start conceptualizing, and our ability to conceptualize is not going to be able to sense things. And the understanding can intuit nothing. The senses can think nothing. Only through their union can knowledge arise. How do we get knowledge? We conceptualize objects. Objects come under conceptualization. You know, knowledge is the combination of a sensed experience, which is conceptualized. So Kant puts forth the mode of cognition called intellectual intuition, which puts forward this idea of a subject who simultaneously intuits and applies concepts to an object, right? That's really what we do all the time, yeah? We're not going around going, here's a USB stick, right? I've got the sense data. Now, what is it? These things happen, okay? So a subject whose mode of thinking and sense presentation were one and the same. This is intellectual intuition. It's what I'd like to think everyone is doing, all subjects are doing. And, you know, they're not divided into intuition and concept. This is, you know, systemization is great. But once again, you have to sort of understand it. Kant builds so you never are mistaking things. Kant's proof that we are, you know, in fact, not this subject is that a subject would have no room for sense experience. For by merely thinking of an object, conceptualizing it, it would appear before them. Okay? Nor would a concept even need to be applied because the object would already be grasped in its totality. From this, okay, the basic thing you have to understand there is that intellectual intuition is the idea that a subject who's simultaneously intuiting and applying concepts at the same time, the two things we just spoke about. We can understand more about the way in which our subjectivity functions from this. You know, we can only think of objects by applying concepts to them, and we can only intuit objects via our senses, and these both have larger implications. So we know things by thinking what they are like, okay, which is an epistemological judgmental form. We'll get to judgments later. So when we go back to the view of time and space as a priori, okay, absolutely necessary, we need them for anything. You know, they're not derived from experience, they are pure intuitions, they're not derived from experience, they are what allows experience to be, the objective framework. Space is understood as the framework for outer sense, okay? It's the external world is in space, and time is the inner sense, okay? So our internal temporal workings come in contact with this external world and process it. Each of these pure intuitions correlates to the outer and inner sense. So one's thoughts succeed each other, you know, we think, okay, so I'm thinking, I'm conceptualizing once again, you know, I've got this blasted pen in space, but when it's going from here to here, my inner sense, you know, when it goes from here to here, time has to happen. What is the processing apparatus which allows that to happen in the subject? It's the inner sense. I have thoughts and understanding and conceptualization that pen is now there, that it's now there. So the inner sense is the thing that processes time, whereas the outer sense, the external world, is the object in itself. And what allows, you know, inner sense is therefore what allows succession. So appearance is, going back to appearance, is Kant's definition of an undetermined object of empirical intuition. You know, if you're wondering why does Kant have all these different terms? He it's very clear that Kant likes to split out this systemization, as I've said, so that, you know, you don't trip up on anything. So when Kant's speaking of appearance, it's the definition is an undetermined object of empirical intuition, something we've intuited, but it's undetermined. Why is it not undetermined? If, you know, anything I've said so far has made sense, it's undetermined because, hopefully you've said, because we haven't conceptualized it yet. An appearance just corresponds to sensation, but it presupposes that sensations conform to a certain form. They're ordered, okay? So, you know, this is still within that realm of time and space. The beautiful thing about the transcendental aesthetic is how it all falls together, okay? The subject's experience, then, the experience of the subject, is not all content of experience. There's the intuition of the object and its appearance as something which is then ordered, okay, from external to internal. It is re-presented to us, and as it is conceptualized, it is ordered in terms of our inner sense. So the form of any appearance of an object gives a unifying structure of that appearance, which is supplied to us a priori by these two powers, the time and space, our subjective intuition. And there is the appearance of the object with its form, a form which allows our intuition to make sense of the object. Okay, so appearance is that first thing that allows us to make sense of it. But it's, you know, there's something that has to happen to the appearance for it to become something we can make sense of. Form is located then between sensibility and thinking, prior to the application of thought, and doesn't arise out of sensation. Form is just what forms the possibility of this. And from this theorization of appearance, it becomes apparent that intuition contains formal a priori elements, allowing Kant to posit that the subject has intuition independent of sensation, okay, of being affected, something prior to sensibility, of our process of synthesis. This is called pure intuition, contains nothing which belongs to sensation, pure. And as I've said, we have two, space and time. There has to be something before any of these appearances arrive. Okay. Now, Dan Robinson has this great analogy. If those of you are sort of wondering, well, how do we not know that? Surely space and time apply, you know, universally, literally universally. Once again, it's that question of we don't know that. You know, Dan, as I said, Dan Robinson, he says, Kant talks about chirality. You know, you can't ever have a left hand glove on a right hand. There is these spatial objects which just won't fit in that way. Now, if we were to contact an alien planet, and this is Robinson's analogy, and ask them if their hearts were also on the left-hand side of their bodies, we don't know whether or not they'd actually be able to answer that, right, that question. Because those assumptions of physiological structure and cognitive apparatus, the entire idea of left-hand side, or of whether or not they even understand what a body is, right? They are assumptions that are made from the cognition which even allows that. Okay, so we just can't question it. Okay, so the ability to discern any of this time and space, you know, the spatiotemporality which we subjectively have, is inbuilt within us. We can't get out of that. And the pure intuition of space relies in part on the idea of appearance, right? Because the subject's pure intuition of space is wherein Kant derives proof of geometrical synthetic a priori judgments, right? So we spoke about synthetic a priori judgments last time, and one of them that's clear is math, right? And math and geometry for Kant, which really can just come under the heading of math, right? So, you know, 5 plus 5 equals 10. There is nothing in 5 plus 5 that does equal 10. You have to do something to work something out. However, there is nothing that's all going on in the inner sense. There's nothing that's coming from the external world, from experience, that teaches us that that is the way. Therefore, it's synthetic and a priori. And geometric truths on, you know, coming from the same, you know, made on this basis of mental construction, of the inner sense of lines and shapes within a mathematical apparatus. By doing these geometric sort of equations or whatever, we're representing space void of appearance without being affected in any way. Okay, so the pure intuition of space allows the subject to study space independently of objects, proving for Kant both the a priori intuition of space and as something which is pure, as void of empirical relation. Thus, like mathematical judgments, from the strict universality of the spatial mathematics of geometry, which can be theoretically undertaken without reference to empirical existence, one can prove that space is this pure intuition. You know, it's something that we can actually know without experience. And this also, the reason I bring in the geometric structures, because for those that will go down that route of Kant, of the maths and geometry, which is a complete labyrinth, these are the two synthetic a priori judgments, which Kant brings up time and time again, maths and geometry, and, you know, this pure intuition of maths and geometry, which actually allows us to investigate the empirical reality without knowing anything from the empirical reality first. And of course, there's huge implications in that with regard to whether or not we have objective truth. The fact is, we can affect the world without it first affecting us. Therefore, perhaps we do know something objective about it via maths and geometry. You know, back to that whole idea of Kant isn't criticizing science. He's clearly for Kant, we know something about science because 1 plus 1 does equal 2, 2 plus 2 does equal 4. So we have something there, right? We have something that works. It works consistently. We have this universal mathematic framework. But, and it's not from experience. So what does that tell us about maths in relation to our experience? So then we move forward into, you know, we spoke about the pure intuition of space there with regard to geometry. What about this pure intuition of time? Okay, so this largely mirrors the pure intuition of space in that it allows for the possibility of a synthetic a priori knowledge. So can we have, we go back once again to these two modes of sense, the outer sense, the external world, and the inner sense of time. And the corresponding argument by Kant is that our inner intuitions, our inner sense, are given to us from within time. Okay, so Kant states that time cannot be outwardly intuited and space cannot be intuited as something in us. Right. So thus, time is a matter of being processed and synthesized via the subject's inner sense. And time comes before space, because space has to be in time, and the objects of its spatiality to exist altogether have to be in time. They also have to be synthesized, which synthesized, if you think of that as a temporal process, by the subject. So when we think back to those, that first foundation of time and space, and why these are actually before objects in existence or concepts of them, they are pure intuitions of time and space. Okay, pure as in not relating to time or space. They have to be already. You know, and just to sort of emphasize these points, for there to be our experiences for man, as in distinct from the subject and not spatially, you know, just distinct from the subject, there has to be space a priori. Before there can be objects distinct from the subject, there needs to be space for them to be in, right? The subject can't refer to a representation outside of themselves unless there is already space there for that representation to appear to them first, okay, a priori. We need space for there to be objects in. There must be space before objects are intuited in space. Thus, the intuition of this a priori space is pure. It has no connection to the empirical objects which we eventually intuit within it. The awarenesses of space precedes awareness of these empirical spaces, representations. Okay, so Kant states, space is not an empirical concept which has been derived from our experience. For in order that certain sensations be referred to something outside me, that is, to something in another region of space from that in which I find myself, and similarly, in order that I may be able to represent them as outside and alongside one another, association, and accordingly, as not only different, but as in different places, the representation of space must already underlie them. Space has to be there first. Therefore, the representation of space cannot be obtained through experience from the relations of our appearance. This our experience itself is itself possible at all only through that representation. Okay. We made it through, but it should be added that representation and knowledge, you know, this is the big emphasis really to take away from the transcendental aesthetic, are two separate factors over our receiving experience. There is our ability to receive representations, and then our ability to understand them as the form of knowledge, and they aren't the same. And this latter power to gain this knowledge is called spontaneity, which we may get to later, and it's this which allows us to extend concepts beyond the range of that possible experience. But that doesn't matter too much here. But a super, super short overview of the transcendental aesthetic is, for there to be experience for the subject, there must be time and space. And for there to be space, there has to be a pure intuition of the possibility of space before there can be objects for us to represent in that space. For there to be space and for us to understand that things can be synthesized and move in space, there has to be time, the inner sense, space, the outer sense, time, the inner sense. Time is in the inner sense, which processes the thing. And from that foundation, we have the objective framework for our experience. Now, how do we experience things? There is an appearance which appears to us in space. We haven't done anything with it yet. As we begin to do stuff with it, it becomes a representation. We are representing this object to us, this appearance. We represent it, And from there, we can conceptualize it. And all of that, or those two things together, intellectual intuition is those two things together, you know, the simultaneous representation and conceptualization of the object all at once. So we sensibly understand this representation, and a completely separate thing from sensibility, conceptualization understands what it is in a general form, which allows us to associate it with other things in experience. And that is a transcendental aesthetic. I think it's fairly simple. But then again, I've spent a lot of time with Kant, so you might not. But hopefully this has helped you. If you've sort of searched this video out on YouTube or found it online, I have a ton of other philosophical stuff and interviews on the channel, so go check that out. If you've enjoyed these or you're finding them helpful, please think about supporting via Patreon and all these things, which are in the description below. I won't go on about them too much. And if you want the notes for this, or if you want to ask me questions about it, sign up to the Patreon, and then you'll be able to comment on the notes page and I can reply to you there, or join the Discord, but which is in the link as well. But yeah, thanks for listening, and I hope it's helped, and I'll see you in the next lecture.